Okay, and we are back with Joshua Key. Hello, Joshua, are you there?
Hello, how are you doing?
Hello, I'm doing all right. How are you doing?
Doing good.
So you've been on tour out here on the West Coast.
Yes.
And how have you been finding that? You've been doing talks in different places. How have you found the response?
It's been awesome.
Yeah?
Yes.
Joshua Key, just to let our listeners know, is a U.S. war resister in Canada, right?
Yes.
And can you maybe give us a bit of the background on that, in terms of who you were serving with and what the whole history was when you went to Iraq?
Okay, I served with the 43rd Combat Engineer Company, based out of Fort Carson, Colorado.
How long were you in Iraq for?
I was in Iraq for 8 months.
Okay, and what period of time was that? When did you get back from Iraq?
I left for Iraq in April 10th of 2003, and I arrived back on November 17th of 2003.
And so what is it that caused you to come out here and start doing a speaking tour about your experiences?
Well, that's a long story that starts way back.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, it started from my experiences in Iraq. There was just no justification for it. When I came back, the only thing I really had known that it was immoral and an illegal to myself.
Mm-hmm.
I took my trips across Canada. We started on July 9th for the basic purpose of letting Canadians know the reasons that we're here and the reasons are justified that we're all here.
Yeah, and how I'm interested in how you ended up in the army, because I understand that it wasn't just a gung-ho patriot thing for you. It was more a necessity for a job and a work. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was more of a necessity to survive, you might say.
I think that's possibly a common experience for many soldiers. Did you find that?
Oh yeah, I would say 99% of the people I served with was in the same boat that I was.
Wow.
It was all from very poor families. We had no future unless we did basically go to the military. If you wanted to go to college, of course. Myself, my wife was pregnant, and I already had two children, so she was pregnant with my third. And I was a skilled welder, and I was making $7.25 in Oklahoma, and it was getting where it wasn't paying the bills.
And when you joined the Army, did you think that you were going to go to Iraq? What did you think you were going to do in the Army?
Well, actually, when I went and talked to my Army recruiter, I was trying to be as concerned as I could and try to look at everything from a point of it's not going to happen to you. When I went and talked to him, I went and took my ASVAB test, which is like a test that basically qualifies you for what you're to do in the military. When my test results came back, they said you have three choices. You can be an infantryman, an MLRS driver, which is a multiple launch rocket systems driver, or you can build bridges.
Mm-hmm.
I told him the best one opportunity-wise, as well as when you get out of the military, is building bridges. I want to build bridges.
Yeah, naturally, being a welder, that would be a suitable job.
Yeah, it'd be something I'm used to in a certain degree.
Mm-hmm.
When I was promised, one of the reasons I got in the military so quick was that my wife was pregnant with our third child.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the military don't allow you to have three children when you sign the dotted line.
Okay.
So is what they did is they just left my wife all out of it.
Wow.
Kept her away from the superiors and things of such, and got me in as fast as they could.
So did you think that you were going to go build bridges in Iraq, or did you think you were going to be working stateside?
Well, actually that's funny, because I asked them that, and they put me in what they call CONUS, which means you can never be sent out of the continental United States of America. They wouldn't even let me be stationed in Hawaii or Alaska. It had to be inside the continental states.
Hmm.
And they were saying how I would never go, and of course, built bridges need to be built anywhere.
Yeah. Now, just to touch on that for one more second, from your experience with the soldiers that were surrounding you in Iraq and in the States before you were sent, is that the case for a lot of soldiers? Are a lot of soldiers told, oh, you're not going to go to Iraq, you're just going to be doing you're going to work along the U.S.-Mexican border or work here and there? Or are most soldiers, are they aware that they're probably going to be sent overseas?
No, I think most are lied to.
Most are lied to.
Yeah, this is something that Michelle Robidoux from the War Resisters Support Coalition also mentioned when we interviewed her, that recruiters are getting somewhat desperate, and so they're really telling people almost whatever they want to hear in order to get them out there.
So
it was about 2 months ago that 47 Army recruiters themselves went AWOL because they couldn't meet the quota.
Hmm. Wow.
You know, that says a lot just in itself.
That recruiters are going AWOL, yeah.
Yes.
How long were you in the Army before you discovered, like, wait a minute, I'm about to be sent to Iraq?
Actually, I had did my basic training. After my basic training, I went to my duty station, which was Fort Carson, Colorado. I was there for 6 months, and then I was overseas.
Mm-hmm. So how many months was that, excuse me?
It was just about a year.
Just about a year in the Army, and then you were told that you were going to be sent to Iraq.
Yes.
And was, is there any recourse? Like, I assume that you sort of stood up and said, like, wait a minute, I'm not supposed to be sent overseas, or...
Well, actually, you know, there was a lot more things when I signed the dotted line that I questioned when I got to my first duty station. I was asking them, why has everything been a lie to me since I was, you know, everything I was told was a lie. I was told by my platoon leader, which is a lieutenant, to basically shut up and get out of his office, and I don't know the military way of life yet.
And did you find that that this was the case with a lot of other soldiers, and, like, how did that affect their morale?
You know, I think it affected us all bad. I mean, you know, most of us that did my job, that I was in explosives and landmines.
Right.
Most of us that did my job, I think we was all told we'd be in there for bridge building or something of the sort. But we had to fit the military's needs and do what we did. So that was just, you know, there was no morale.
Yeah, and it must be kind of a big deal when you're, you know, you're in a position to give your life for something and it's really unclear as to what that is, and, you know, you've been told one thing and you see another. And
well, you know, when I went to Iraq, you know, as well as my wife, you know, I was under the impression, I mean, everything I was hearing was weapons of mass destruction. You know, I need to take care of it now before my children have to when they get older. I mean, I was ready to go. You know, everything pointed towards the fact that they had all these things. And, of course, I was in the military, so all you're hearing is what they want you to hear.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I left, I was ready to kill. That's what I was trained for.
Mm-hmm.
So then you arrive in Iraq with a bunch of other people. Many of you lied to, but you still feel, okay, this is the right thing to do, even if I didn't really want to do this part of it. And then what happens? Tell us a little bit about your first few weeks in Iraq.
Okay. Well, you know, when we first got to Kuwait, of course, you know, we got there and they had told us that they didn't have enough food or water to provide for us, so they had to ration us water and MREs.
Even water?
Yes. So I think that hit us all pretty hard of how in the world can the, you know, the strongest military in the world be out of water and food for their troops.
Wow.
Shortly after, of course, we was in Iraq when we got there. They told me, you know, your primary job has changed. You'll be doing raids, traffic control points, and patrolling the streets.
Wow. Heavy.
And, you know, that was crazy. I mean, you know, I mean, today I look back and it's very crazy.
Mm-hmm. Are there, to your knowledge, I mean, with the people that you were, that you came in contact with in Iraq, are there a lot of instances of people sort of disobeying orders and stuff? Or I guess in Iraq, the situation would be extremely tense all the time. So do you find that people sort of don't want to do it, but end up doing it anyway because they don't have a choice? Or is there a beginning of sort of just people going, no, I'd rather go to jail? Because as we know, I mean, at least here in Canada and in other places, we reading history about Vietnam and stuff like that, by the last couple of years in Vietnam, there was a lot of disobeying orders, lawlessness, drug use amongst the troops in Vietnam. And I'm wondering, what stage is it at in Iraq? Are there a lot of people sort of just saying, I'm not going to play this game? Or is it still kind of, I don't want to do this, but I'm going to do it anyway?
You know, I was in Fallujah, Iraq, and my squad leader, he was a very nice man. He told us one night, we was on guard duty, he goes, you know what, guys, if we could all set down our weapons right now and just say we're not going to do this no more, he goes, I'll tell you what'll happen. He was married, I was married, and another guy in my squad was married. He goes, all three of us will have our pay tokens, and how would our family make it? Well, it was just about 2 weeks after that, a colonel had came to my my company and was, you know, like doing a presentation, you might say. You're not authorized to ask him a question. Well, one of the guys in my platoon asked him, why is it that we had the Vietnam-style flak vests? Until this date, we were still wearing them. He didn't answer. The next day, my friend got called into the commander's tent, and he got half of his pay taken for 6 months for asking that question.
Wow.
Whoa.
And, you know, and that's when I realized I can't say anything because how would my family make it?
And that was just a question about the equipment you're using.
Exactly. It's just a question that he asked for the better of all of us. But just because it wasn't authorized and because he shouldn't have said it, he got half of his pay taken for that long.
And you were mentioning earlier, I understand this is probably a bit of a sensitive subject, but you were saying that you were assigned on raids and checkpoints.
Yes.
And I understand that entails a lot of civilian involvement. And what kind of things did you see in terms of that?
Well, raids are like, that's one of my very my topics I try to hit, because that was very traumatic to myself, as well as I suffer with post-traumatic stress from all of it.
Yeah.
But in the raids, it's I'll just go through one. We would go up and we put C4 on the door. You blow the door in. You run in with a 5 to 6 man team, and you take all males that look of the age of 16 or over. You throw them outside. They get sent off for interrogations.
And they'd go to jail, or?
Yes. I mean, you know, in the start of it is that we always had military intelligence, CIA intelligence, satellite photographs of this house. They would always say something's in there, from a terrorist to cache of weapons. I did over 100, and I never found any weapons, and I never found any terrorists. All I found was traumatized families, and their husbands and their children still got sent off for interrogation, whether nothing was found or not.
And so these people, these men, 16 and over, would go to places, for example, like Abu Ghraib,
exactly,
perhaps?
Yeah.
Where they were often tortured or...
And how...
For no reason whatsoever.
At the end of... again, I'm very interested in the mind frame and the state of mind of the American soldiers, because obviously it's not hard to imagine what goes through the mind of an Iraqi when his front door is blown apart by C4 explosives and a whole bunch of soldiers run into his house in the middle of the night and drag him out when he knows that he's done nothing.
Exactly.
And they don't find any weapons or anything, and he ends up getting sent to somewhere where he may face some kind of psychological or physical torture for doing nothing at all. But I'm wondering... Of the mind state of the American soldiers, like at the end of such a raid, when you guys would be back in your barracks or in your tents or whatever, what sort of conversations or discussions would happen between you guys?
You have different ones. You know, you have what I like to call G.I. Joe soldiers. I mean, they're happy and motivated. They did it and ready to go do another. Mm-hmm. You've had other soldiers like myself and a lot of my friends that were... Why did we do that for them? What was the purpose of it? Was there justification for that, or did we just ruin their house and their families for what?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you have your differences.
Did you guys get any sort of training on the etiquette of how to treat Muslim? Like, for example, how to treat and talk or handle Muslim women and stuff like that? Because obviously it's a different culture and there are sensitivities that need to be adhered to. I'm wondering if you got any sort of training for when you're dealing in a checkpoint or during a raid or anything of how to approach a woman, how to touch a woman, or if you need to and stuff like that.
You know, I would say we got very, very little of that. Nothing for what we should have had.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we had, before we left to go to Iraq, we had what they call these briefings. We had briefings on, you know, this is what they mean when, like, they show their foot to you. This is what they mean when they show their hand to you. But we didn't learn none of their language. I mean, that was always, you know, that's another topic I hit on, is we didn't know what they were saying.
Did you have translators with you during the raids and stuff like that?
A lot of times, no.
Hmm. Wow.
No.
And, so you had to just kind of yell at them in English, I guess.
Exactly. And, I mean, how do they know what you're saying?
Wow.
I mean, it was a traffic control point I had in Fallujah. It was the first time that I really seen the language barrier kill somebody.
And what happened there?
And that's that we was on a traffic control point. Basically, you stop every vehicle and you want to see if they got contraband inside, weapons inside, something of that such. Well, the military operating procedure is if the vehicle did not stop when they were told to stop, then you light it up, which basically means you destroyed the vehicle. Well, at that time, we had no signs saying stop. We had no translators there saying stop. The only thing we know to do was raise our hands and wave and say stop. And that happened, and a man and a child came through. They completely lit up the vehicle. I went back because I was up front. We had to pull some perimeter to, you know, surround the vehicle to see what was, you know, what had happened exactly.
Mm-hmm.
The child was, his father was dead, and the child was in pieces. We bandaged him up as fast as we could, and we took him to the closest hospital, which is not, we weren't even supposed to do that.
Wow.
But we did. And when we came back, we sat there and searched that vehicle to the T, and there was nothing in it. And that's when we all realized that these people are dead, basically, because they didn't know what stop meant.
Oh.
I've heard also that the hand signal for stop actually means something different to people in Iraq.
I mean, most of the time, even here, even in back home, it means hi.
Yeah.
I mean, you're just waving, you know, trying to wave them to stop.
Yeah.
That's all you really can do.
What are, on a sort of, were there any points in Iraq where you or your fellow soldiers felt like, wow, I'm doing a good thing right now, and I'm sort of, I'm helping these people? Like, were there lighter points? Were there points where you really felt like, oh, I'm putting smiles on Iraqi faces, or was it pretty much a nightmare from start to finish for you?
You know, at first you try to tell yourself that you're there for a reason, you're there for a purpose. And I would say that ended very quickly, and then I was just completely disturbed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think most of us were. I mean, it was, it's very disturbing knowing that you've been sent to fight a war for the greed of your president.
Yeah.
And so how began your process of trying to get out? I mean,
you know, actually it was, you know, like I had a lot of turning points. You know, I had my friends, I had a few of my good friends get their legs blown off. I seen people's heads blown off by machine gun fire. There was lots of things that pointed towards it, and it was in October of 2003 they said that I would get to go home for 2 weeks to visit my family. When they said that, basically I completely shut my mouth. I didn't say a word to nobody. They let me come home. It was in November of 2003. They said I could go home for 2 weeks, and then I'd have to report back to Baghdad afterwards. When I came home, I just talked to my wife, and I told her some things. We called the military lawyers, your JAG office. I approached them to the fact that, you know, I already have nightmares. Is there any way you could just give me a job back on base? Is there any kind of anything we can do?
Mm-hmm.
They told me to call them the next day. They told me I only had two options. They said you can either go to prison or get on the plane.
Wow.
From that point on, I told my wife we have to run.
And how did you come to, were there people helping you? I mean, I don't want any names or ideas like that, but were there organizations that said, like, hey, you can get to Canada and stuff like that? Or was it just sort of like you had the idea, oh, yeah, there's, like, Canada has been in the past a safe haven for war resistors. I'm going to try my luck over there.
Well, we all knew that to an extent. I mean, like, when we took on the run from the start, we went to Philadelphia, and we was in hiding there for 14 months, living motel to motel every 30 days.
Wow.
Living in constant fear as well as working in fear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I thought at first that they might just leave me alone. I went and served my country. I fought for my country, even though it was just for one person. But I was thinking they might just leave me alone. You know, I did it. But then I know in the back of my mind that it can't happen like that. So then I started looking. I started trying to find out as much information as I could. And that's when I found out that Jeremy Heinzman and some others were here claiming for refugee status. So then I started doing my homework even more. I checked out, you know, I know an American's never been granted refugee status here as well as political asylum. And then, like I told my wife, you know, the world has to change. There has to be something to change.
Wow.
One sort of thing I was wondering about as a bit of an aside to what you're just saying is what kind of impressions and feelings did you have coming from a place like Iraq and what was going on there? And coming back to the U.S., I mean, I imagine that in some ways there's culture shocks in both directions.
It's a massive. I mean, you know, I went from when I was in Iraq, I was in the red zones except for 2 weeks the entire time I was there. So I was always in constant communication with Iraqis. I was always seeing firefights. I got mortar attacked every night. Then one day I just get on the plane and I come back home, and then you're just free. I mean, you know, you don't have to worry about people shooting at you. You don't have to worry about getting killed at night. It's a very big shock, and then especially when you know that you're more angry and frustrated at the people who sent you there and their reasons for sending you there.
And what about other U.S., you know, U.S. civilians and their responses to you or
yeah.
things that were said to you?
And your family's response and your wife's family and friends and stuff like that?
Well, at first they considered me a hero, but I'm not a hero for what I did there. You know, I don't even see how I could be labeled for that. When I got off the plane in Dallas, Texas, there was veterans from past wars lined all the way down the hall when you walked off the plane. And they were congratulating you and all this and that. And it disgusted me because what am I getting congratulated for? For invading another country and having to do the things I had to do to end the people. There's no honor in that.
And then how's the response been since you decided to at first go AWOL and then go to Canada to seek asylum?
My mother's been very, very supportive.
Mm-hmm.
My mother, my brother, my grandfather, my wife's family, they're not as supportive, but, I mean, they love us, but they don't agree with the decision we made.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, it takes time. You know, they still believe that we're fighting in Iraq because of 9/11. So.
Because of 9/11.
Exactly.
Wow, it's amazing. Sitting here in Canada, it's amazing to think that there are still people who believe that Iraq has anything to do with 9/11. And I know that there are people in Canada who believe that too, but it's been so widely discredited in media outlets that we get over here.
Yes.
That the thought that there's still people who can say, oh, we're there because of the towers coming down on 9/11 is mind-boggling.
Yeah, even in the mainstream news here, it's quite widely recognized that it's, you know, that's not a connection anymore.
Well, you know, I always hit on a topic that whenever we was in hiding for 14 months, I watched the news constantly because you want to see what updates, you want to see what's going on in Iraq.
Mm.
Every day, a U.S. soldier dies, and they always say he dies by the hands of a terrorist.
Mm-hmm.
By the hands of a terrorist. You know, that disturbs me because how can they consider people terrorists who are fighting for what they have, and that's all they have? They're fighting because their houses are blown up, their children are dead. They've been killed for no reason whatsoever.
Yeah, what do we expect them to do, really?
You know, is what gets me is in most civilizations and in past times, wouldn't they be considered freedom fighters?
Yeah.
Do you
mind if I ask you, when you were sort of growing up or in the last few years in Oklahoma and you're the people surrounding you and since you've been on the run, what have been your news sort of sources? Like what networks do you turn to get news yourself?
I read.
You read?
I read. I think everything's in facts. You know, the mm-hmm. news don't tell you the accurate truth. They always foreshadow it.
Yeah.
So you have to get the facts, and that's what I thrive on, and that's what I go on.
Okay.
So this must have been quite an amazing awakening for you in many ways.
Well, you know, I feel like I've been lied to for my whole entire life living in the United States. I feel that, you know, I've been... You might say brainwashed to an extent. You might say patriotic. You could say whatever you wanted to say. But I was blinded to what the world thought about many different things that we should have known.
So you went kind of through a transition from being on the run to also being a public figure and speaking out. Do you feel like, you mentioned earlier that you have post-traumatic stress disorder, do you feel like speaking out's maybe a part of your therapy? Or
actually, I feel like it is, yes. I mean, it has to be told, and it has to come out, and then it does help me when I do it.
Mm-hmm. Have you had a lot of contact with some of the anti-war organizations in the States, like Veterans for Peace and Code Pink and
I've had communication with a few, yes, like Iraqi war veterans who speak out, Gold Star family members, different organizations like that, yes.
Mm-hmm. And I assume that those people have given you a lot of moral support at the least?
Oh, very much.
Yeah.
Very, very much. We get a lot of donations, like money-wise, from back home, too, as well. It's outrageous, really, the support we get.
Outrageous. I guess it's also a big transition going from the sort of insular environment of soldiers and war and that whole, like, it's almost like a frat house kind of environment, I'd imagine, too. Yeah, being accepted into the anti-war movement and having people help out in that way, I imagine it's been a big transition as well.
It has been, but it's been very, very good. You know, I would have never thought that we could have came here and got as much help as we did, like with the War Resistor Support Campaign. It's been, they're the reasons we're doing this now. You know, they help us out. They know how to contact people. They're great.
Mm-hmm. How has it been on your family? I understand you have three children now, or
I have four children.
Children.
Yes.
How's it been on your children and on your wife? This whole experience. I assume it cannot be an easy experience to uproot and leave what you have. At the same time, though, they want to see you safe and with them. So how do they feel about this?
You know, my children, I don't let them know. They just know what they need to know, and that's not much at all. I mean, I don't want to get my children involved in this. They're all young, and I want them to enjoy their lives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the things that I have to do to keep them safe is just that things I have to do.
Right.
You know, my wife is very, very supportive, and I know it's rough on her because she can't go see her family as well. But she's great. We're together, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So just sort of sum up, what is your legal and I guess financial and stuff situation now? Like, how are you doing here in Canada?
We live off donations basically. So like when we travel and do different speeches, basically we just live off the donations that we receive. As well as my status right now, I'm applying for refugee status. I go to court on September 2nd in Toronto. I'll be the first person who's went to Iraq who goes to, in front of the Immigration and Refugee Board.
Wow.
And I assume you have a lawyer for that?
Yes, Jeffrey House, based in Toronto, yes.
And what are his thoughts on it? What are the feelings? Are you guys calling for people in the Toronto area who are supporting to come out on September 2nd, or is this still going to be sort of a let's see how this goes sort of thing?
You know, I really don't know about that. Myself, I say everybody get out and support on September 2nd, mm-hmm. as well as the September 24th. But I don't know exactly how the process will go or not. I know that I'm going to give them hell.
I've heard as well that it's actually quite a big deal that you're the first one who's actually been to Iraq, because there's questions as to whether you can mention or question the legality of the war, but you can talk about war crimes being committed, and that can be a legal thing. I don't know how much of this you can talk about, but...
Well, you know, I've tried to tell myself that no matter what way it goes, nobody can tell me what I didn't see, because I've seen it with my own eyes. It's not like I'm just guessing it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, you've been very, very brave in speaking out and doing a really amazing job. So I say thanks for coming out here and telling us your story.
Oh, well, I say thank you for having me and listening.
Yes, thank you very much. And tell us a little bit about your next speaking dates, just because I know that you are speaking in a few spots that are within our listening range. So
yes.
If you want to mention a few dates and locations in BC, that would be great.
Well, I mean, I think all we have for BC left is we have Salt Spring Island tonight.
Tonight at Salt Spring? Where is that and at what time?
It's based in the town center. I couldn't give you the exact details.
Okay.
I know that it's the Hiroshima and Nagasaki Festival.
Okay.
And I think it starts at around 5.
Okay. We do have a lot of listeners on Salt Spring, so if you're listening on Salt Spring and wondering what you should do tonight, you can go out and meet and listen to Joshua. And is your wife going to be there as well?
Yes, she will, yes.
Okay, so Joshua and Brandy Key, and show them your support, because it's very important right now as Canadians that we demand from our government to give asylum to people, because just as we showed our resistance and to the war and demanded our government not to take part in it, now we have to help the Americans who are waking up and not wanting to go. And I understand there's also a website where people can sign a petition to this effect?
Yes, it's www.resistors.ca.
Resistors.ca.
It gives biographies of all of us that are who are here applying for refugee status, as well as all updated events, newsletters, as well as petitions and all.
All right, great. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us this morning, Joshua, and good luck, and we're rooting for you.
Thank you very much.
All right, take care, and
take
good
care.
Luck tonight at Salt Spring.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
So just for people that are, you know, maybe only heard the end of that was Joshua Key, a former U.S. soldier who's now a war resister, and he's on tour here on the West Coast talking about his experiences. And thank you to the guest host, Elan.
Thank you for having me.